Good morning. In the 40 years since we introduced the new lectionary, we've gotten to know the Gospels pretty well because we read the synoptics stem to stern, one each year on the three-year cycle. We read John every year during Lent and Easter. Likewise, the rest of the New Testament gets pretty systematic treatment, book by book. We don't read it all, but we work our way through it. Three or four Sundays for a shorter book, 12 or 16 for the larger and more important ones. We dwell on them long enough to get to know them. The books of the Old Testament, however, don't get that situation. The first reading is a setup for the gospel. So it's picked to match the theme of the gospel, and therefore comes more or less at random from different books of the Tanakh or the Apocrypha. One week the first reading might be from Exodus, the next week from Second Book of Kings, the third week from Sirach, fourth and back and round. We never get to know the individual books. So for the last dozen or so years, what we've been doing here is to take a few weeks during the summer and look at a particular part of the Old Testament for its own sake. Spend some time dwelling on the individual books and their message. We started, of course, with the Tanakh, first with the Torah, and then the prophets, and then the writings. And then year before last, we finished the Tanakh. Last year, we began the Apocrypha, the books that, while many of them were written in Hebrew, the Hebrew was not preserved. They weren't a part of the reading tradition of the synagogues in Israel. But their Greek translations did find their way into the reading cycles in the synagogues in the diaspora, in Alexandria and Antioch and Corinth and Rome and all the cities to which Jewish colonies had spread. These places preserve those books in Greek. So, after the destruction of the temple, when which scrolls do we count as sacred became a real question, the Greek scrolls were excluded by the rabbis at Jabna, but they continued to be used in the diaspora. And since, of course, Christians were primarily made in the Greek-speaking world, we took over the Greek version of the Old Testament. And what was for them sacred books became for us sacred books. The Apocrypha. Texts in Greek. Well, we were reading even the Tanakh in Greek. We read the Septuagint, so it all worked together. Protestants came along and said, oh, no, they weren't in the Jewish Bible, they're not being ours. So they took them out. Later, most Protestant Bibles would put them back in, but generally in a section by themselves labeled the Apocrypha or the Deuterocanonical books between the New Testament and the Old Testament, or in the back, somewhere around. In Catholic Bibles, they're sort of spread out throughout the rearrangement of the books, so you have to look for them. They're not much used in the liturgy, except for a couple. They become sort of the little lost sheep of the Bible. Well, maybe the littlest and the lostest of all those sheep is the book we begin with this week, the book of Judith. It's a little book, 16 chapters. Read it in a half an hour without pushing. It's a short story, clearly intended to be such. It's a fable and gives itself away as a fable right at the beginning. The very first verse says, in the 12th year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Assyria. You know what that sounded like in Jewish ears? That sounded like you reading a story that begins, in 1909, when Abraham Lincoln was king of England. You know immediately the literary genre you're dealing with after that line. Nebuchadnezzar was not king of Assyria. who was king of Babylon. And they all knew it because they'd been slaves under him in Babylon. He was the one that instigated the Babylonian captivity. And the geography, like the history, is sort of mismatched and invented. It's a world like some of the movies that come out today, partially live, partially animated, wholly fantastical. That's in the Bible? Yeah. Because it's true. Don't confuse truth and history. It's not history. It doesn't purport to be history. It's a fable. It's a short story. But that's just as true as history. All kinds of literature in the Bible. There's history in the Bible. There's parable in the Bible. There's apophthegm in the Bible. There's fiction in the Bible. And all of it's inspired. And all of it teaches the truth. In its own way. Don't go looking for historical truth in a short story. But it teaches the truth. Well, what truth does it teach? Why is it there? I mean, we never hear it, do we? Well, no, we don't. This may be the first time you've ever heard it at liturgy. It's not in the Sunday cycle. We never read it on a Sunday. It's not even in the weekday cycle. You come to Mass every day, and if we're doing the weekday cycle, you'll never hear it. The only place it shows up, one tiny appearance in the lectionary, it's one, I think, the eighth optional reading for commons of saints if the saint in question is a widow. And it does nothing about that grand climax that we just had presented for us. It's all about how she observed her widowhood so strictly and was such a pious young lady. That's probably not going to be read very often, very many places. So you probably never heard it read. Well, if you've never heard it read, and it's tucked away in different places in different Bibles, it's not history anyway, what's it there for? Well, a couple of things. One, I think it's written as a role model story for young Jewish girls. She's the perfect young Jewish girl. Well, now young Jewish woman. In fact, she doesn't even have a name. Judith is now a name. There are people named Judith since this book was written. But at the time, it simply meant Jewish woman. Jewess, we used to say. You know, now we just talk about Jewish people in general. Well, in Hebrew, you did the same thing. Yudah, Yudit. It meant Jewish woman. She didn't even get a name of her own. She's the archetypal Jewish woman. She's faithful to the covenant. She's pious. She keeps her widowhood strictly. She doesn't come down from her rooftop cell except for festivals. But she raised a woman of great sense and great courage. She's not a little shriveled up thing, you know, the way she pretended to be for Holofernes. She's beautiful. And she's smart. And she's strong. And she's got guts. And she relies on the Lord. Everything you want to teach your daughter. I mean, there's plenty of role models for Jewish boys in the Tanakh. Son, grow up to be like Moses. You see what David did? Grow up to be like that. You see what Solomon did here? Not what he did over there, but see what he did here? Grow up to be like that. There aren't as many women to be held up as heroes in the Tanakh. There are some. There are some great role models. But not nearly as many as you've got for the boys. So let's create another one so that we can teach our daughters how to be strong, beautiful, smart, courageous, pious, Jewish women. It's a good idea. And because, of course, our religion simply is a renewal and expansion of that same covenant, it's not a bad idea for teaching Christian girls either. See who she was? She didn't try to be a man. In fact, one of her things that made it work was her womanliness. But she took over all the characteristics that we associate in our society, and they did, of course, too, with men. Men were supposed to be smart. Women didn't have to be smart. She was smart. Men were supposed to be courageous. Women didn't have to be courageous. She was courageous. She was strong. You know how much energy it takes to sever a neck? Especially if you're holding the head by one hand, that means you're swinging the sword with one hand. In the old days, people used to tip their executioners to make sure the headsman got a good heavy swing and got it done right the first time. This young widow beheads the guy. Be like that. Well, I'm not sure we want to teach our girls to behead people with one stroke. But be courageous. Be strong. These are good things to teach. But there's a broader lesson there, a lesson for all of us, a lesson that was brought out very well in Judith's presentation here for us. It's not who she is that counts. It's who God is that counts. Rely on the Lord. There are a lot of tie-ins between the Judith reading and the Passover story. Israel is in desperate straits. They are sore oppressed, and it looks like they cannot stand. They cry out to the Lord, and the Lord raises up someone to deliver them. An improbable someone. Moses was 80 years old. How many guys 80 years old do we expect to create a new nation and lead people out into the desert for 40 years? Judith was a widow. Didn't expect anything out of them in those days. God will raise up improbable leaders and bring the people through. God's saving power is always there. It's there for us as it was there for them. Call out to God. Rely on God. Don't give God ultimatums. You got 5 days. But call out to God in faith, and God will come through. That's an important message for us. Well worth a half an hour to reread or read for the first time even the book of Judith. God will deliver us. God has the power. God has the will. Of course, there's also a secondary thing that might be a little unsettling. After you speak to God, listen for God. Listen carefully. Because God is capable of raising up very improbable leaders to deliver God's people. So if you cry out to God for deliverance, be prepared to be told, it's coming. And it's coming through you. Get up and do this. Sisters and brothers, let us pray.